Hi, it's Susan, and I'm an expert in helping musicians to have better relationships with themselves and with the world. In this episode, we meet software engineer Patrick Johnson. During the pandemic in 2020, Patty was fascinated by the ways in which he could see tech helping other people. So rather than a push, the pandemic was a nudge for him to seek a new professional challenge. As a cellist, he'd been quite the musical explorer, so software design is really just a new way for him to play and solve problems. Enjoy! Welcome to today's episode of the Change Your Tune podcast. I'm your host, Susan Eldridge, and today I'm really delighted to welcome our guest, software developer, Patrick Johnson. Patty, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Can you tell us about your work in software development? Because I believe it's a fairly recent transition for you.
That's entirely correct. I mean, it's recent to the point where I'm still in the process of landing a job. So basically, I did a software boot camp at the start of this year. I finished a couple of months ago, and now I've been out doing the whole rigmarole that comes with trying to land some gainful employment. I've been doing interviews and code tests and sending off applications and all the rest of it, and keeping my fingers crossed that I can start to earn some money for my new skills sometime soon.
And what are you learning from the process of putting yourself up through all these? Because you said there's a couple of different requirements in these applications, right? You mentioned code testing and interviewing. So what are you learning?
Yeah. Well, I think in a nutshell, I'm learning that it is completely and utterly different to everything that I had become accustomed to through applying for jobs as an orchestral musician. As one example, even CV structures are completely different. And if you're looking for an orchestral job, really your CV will be a list of orchestras that you played with, and that's basically it. A personal statement and a list of hobbies and interests aren't going to save your case if you can't play in tune. I think with software, there's a bit more open-endedness in terms of what sort of personalities they're looking for and what sort of backgrounds they're looking for. It appears to be a good time for career changers because there's an understanding that we bring a more diverse set of soft skills than people maybe would if they're coming through the traditional avenues of, you know, getting a computer science degree and all the rest of it. In terms of the actual process, that's again a big contrast to what I've previously been accustomed to. I'm currently interviewing for a few places. Every time I think I've done the final interview, there's then like another round of talking to somebody else in the company about things that are largely similar to what I spoke about in the previous round, but somehow slightly different. And if you're going for an orchestral job, you can land a job without saying a single word if you play your cards right, and definitely not in the audition. So I think code tests are probably the closest thing that software has to auditions, but even those are a bit more flexible. They're much less sort of finite in terms of, you know, your margin for error. I mean, in an orchestral audition, you can be out of the running after a couple of notes if those notes happen to feature a scratch or a little bit of out of tuneness or some fairly minute blip. With code tests, they don't have to be perfect. As if you are able to explain your logic, you can get away with a lot. I really wish we could do that in auditions. if I had a bad experience with an excerpt, if I can then tell them that I meant to play it in tune, and this is what, then perhaps I could redeem myself. But
the language that that coders use is, it's not a bug, it's a feature. So you could say, oh yes, the E flat I inserted was a feature in the melody that Beethoven perhaps hadn't considered the merits of.
That's right. This is Beethoven 2.0. It's the latest upgrade.
Fascinating. It's really fascinating to hear that difference, that how in tech they're interviewing for the whole person.
Yes, that's a very good way of putting it.
So you mentioned, Patty, a little bit about, obviously you're a trained musician. Can you go right back to the very start and take us from, the first time you had a cello, or maybe you started on another instrument, and how did you get to hear from there?
So I think my origin story is a bit unconventional. I started at the, I guess, comparatively late age of 12. I mean, I don't think it's a late age at all, but some people may disagree. And I basically, when I went into high school, I, without even really giving it much thought, took a musical aptitude test as part of sort of joining the new cohort of people who were in my music class. And then the next thing I knew, I was lumbered with a cello, and I wasn't the best at fitting in, so I wasn't entirely thrilled about this in the beginning. But they needed cellists. They didn't. They only had a couple, and they needed people who could, play in their string group. And it was decided that I would get the nod, and I'm very grateful for that because I quickly discovered that I absolutely loved it. And I went exploring. I started listening to cello music and to classical music as a whole, even just to kind of get a better sense of what I was getting into. And I became completely obsessed to the extent where I would scour the radio listings for pieces that had cello in them somewhere, and sometimes I'd set my alarm for 5 in the morning to tape a 5-minute piece of cello music off the radio and then go back to bed. So I still have this big archive of cassette tapes that I use to sort of pirate large swathes of music from the Radio 3. And part and parcel with this obsession that I had, I practiced like mad. I was very keen to be stuck in and very keen to play all these amazing pieces that I'd heard, even if they were ideas that were well above my station in a number of regards. But that did mean that I was able to make up for a lot of lost time. So by the time I was ready to look at music college, I'd already done various things, led my local youth orchestra, to my grade 8, won some local competitions, and so I started off at the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama in Glasgow. Then after that, I went to the Guildhall School in London, and then basically started freelancing for the next, decade and a bit. And it was a really amazing experience. I got a huge variety of things that I got to do. No 2 days were alike. And I worked up quite a bit of a portfolio of work ranging from sort of gigs with professional orchestras to studio sessions to my students as well, and West End shows, the whole shebang, a little bit of everything. And then we had the pandemic, and a lot of that kind of changed overnight. And I think that on its own, it maybe wasn't the entire nudge to look at an alternative, but it was definitely a catalyst. And I think tech was an interesting one because I was quick to notice that the responses to the pandemic and the lockdown were very, very different between these two industries. I think amongst us musicians, there were a lot of heads in the sand, and I think a bit of a reluctance to kind of take the situation and make the most of it. Whilst tech, by contrast, was the thing that was keeping everybody sane and able to function in some sort of capacity, people were able to still work without actually having to go into an office. People were able to get groceries if they were vulnerable and had to shield. We were able to, in the very least, attempt to trace people who had coronavirus or who were in contact with people who had. And And a lot of small businesses were able to survive because they were still able to distribute, even though they couldn't technically stay open. So I could see that a move into tech would be an opportunity to provide some meaningful help to people, and to do some sort of work that would be like satisfying on a very deep level, because I knew that I'd be providing a service that people conceivably would desperately need. And so from there, I began to just dip a toe in to see if I had any interest or aptitude for it. And I started doing a bit of self-study. Again, this is one of the great things about software, is that there are a lot of resources out there if you just want to learn something. And there are a lot of resources out there if you want to learn something and you have no money to spend on it. I started doing a bit of study on JavaScript and HTML and CSS and a few other bits and bobs. I discovered that I really enjoyed the problem solving side of it, the creativity, I enjoyed the versatility and malleability of JavaScript, the way that you could sort of make anything work if you Frankensteined it hard enough, which probably isn't the most constructive way to do it, probably isn't the best practice, but when push comes to shove, you can make a lot of stuff work for you. And I found that really satisfying. And I found that I seemed to be progressing with it quite quickly. So I decided to take it to the next level and to look into some boot camp options to just see if I could accelerate my path into the industry. And I did some careful comparing and asking around and research, and eventually decided to go with General Assembly. And I joined the boot camp at the very start of February and stayed there for 12 weeks and had the time of my life. And now I'm here.
I'm just stunned. I'm just enjoying this story so much. And it, I know the listeners, you can't see us, but Patty and I are talking together on Zoom, and the difference in your facial expression between when you were talking about a life immersed in music and or professional work immersed in music and the work you do now, it's staggering. Like, you're smiling now and I can see you just look completely different. The inner experience that you are having when you speak about what you're doing now is so drastically different to 3 minutes ago when you were talking about being a musician. It's quite startling.
Wow. Well, I'm excited about what lies ahead. I'm not going to lie. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm really, really excited.
I'm really, Patrick, interested to dig in a little bit, if it's okay with you. The comment you used about many musicians having their heads in the sand, and but that, and how you had a worldview beyond yourself and the next gig, which is what many freelance portfolio musicians have. So how were you different? How did you come to be different? And secondly, you talked about a search for meaning, and how that element has either become uncovered in the pandemic for you, or was something that you were seeking previously that you weren't getting. So could you speak to those two things for me?
I think so, yeah. I mean, in terms of sort of the heads burying in the sand, I think that it took a lot of time for many musicians that I would witness sort of through my own interactions as a freelancer to reconcile with the idea that the world was different and they were going to have to adapt, and things were going to have to operate in a different way. And even just little things like I took to teaching online, which for a long time was the only option. I just accepted it was the reality. I'd actually attended online lessons a couple of years previously. Like I knew a lady called Nicole Wilson, who runs a company called Musical Orbit, and she's all about connecting sort of young professionals with sort of section principals and soloists, and she was using Zoom before it was cool. So I knew that online teaching does work as a medium, and I never questioned it. And part of it is also that my methodologies as a teacher tend to rely on sort of explanation and questioning and things that don't require physical presence. So I never regarded it as an obstacle, and I actually found that there were some unexpected benefits that I couldn't replicate with in-person lessons. One of them being that if I had a young student who was playing a scale and scanning my face to see if they were in tune or not, instead of like listening to themselves, I could just turn off the camera and it was great. I can't do that in person, but I saw this is an opportunity. I also enjoyed the greater spontaneity when we could schedule the lessons, which for me as a father of one teaching other people who would maybe have siblings or children of their own was definitely a lifeline. But yeah, I think the majority of people that I knew didn't sort of regard this as anything that could have any sort of plus points. And that's just the teaching side of things. I think in terms of performing, I think there are a lot of people who are sort of searching for a sense of purpose and a sense of relevance, and were recording little concerts from their living rooms that they'd sort of post on YouTube. And in a lot of cases, not necessarily considering how to monetize it or what effects an abundance of free content would have on any future attempts to monetize it. And yeah, in a nutshell, I was seeing that there were reactions to what was going on, but there were far fewer reactions that seemed particularly constructive. And I think that was what troubled me.
Yes, absolutely. And I that still that sense of crisis management still seems to be influencing a lot of decision making, and both in individual musicians and in some organizations, still a refusal to accept that a door has closed behind us and there is no going back. And so, as exactly as you said, what is the opportunity to consider what sits ahead and how we bring the best of what has gone before us and leave the things that were not serving us well. And I think it comes to this, the way we're trained as classical musicians, which is to have a fetish for the past.
I think that's a fair statement. I think the idea of sort of disrupting convention and doing things that are radical and risky is, I think it's a mentality that a lot of us sort of hold on the inside in the desperate hopes that somebody will give us permission to do those things.
Yeah, and that's such that whole permission-based thinking, or I call it learned helplessness.
Oh, that's a good one. I like that.
Yeah, that's it's not what you are doing as a music educator by turning the camera off. But it's what so much of music education is. It's compliant, it's error detection, and yeah, and it's embedded at every model of the experience. I mean, if you play in a fairly quality youth orchestra, you don't put the chairs out. You should. They're so, you should, because that's like, yeah, because you have to have a realization that someone has to do it or it doesn't get done. And the value of all of the parts of the machine working together in order that the music can happen. But so much at every level of experience has the decision making and the requirement to be responsible been taken away from musicians, that that's how we end up. They eventually get funneled through a smaller and smaller pipe through the conservatory model and out the other end, and we end up with these incredibly well-trained people who have had the creativity and curiosity knocked out of them, and an inability to actually function in the world because they can't think.
Yeah, I think that's a fair observation. I mean, I know many exceptions to that, and I would hope that I was one of them myself, but definitely any efforts that I've made to not sort of be squeezed wholesale through that pipeline have been very, very conscious. But it's interesting what you say, because one of the more surprising discoveries that I had when I, so by the time I finished my software boot camp, was that writing code was making me feel more creative than I'd felt in years. And I'd come from a creative industry, so how is that supposed to work? But it's just purely because of the presence of a slate that was much cleaner. That's how you're able to create things. If you have fewer expectations that are levied upon you from the starting point before you've had any opportunity to put chalk to slate.
It's so wonderful to hear you say that, Patty. And we've had the very first interview in this podcast is actually with a gentleman called Jeff Miller, who's a incredible woodwork expert in woodworking. He makes incredible furniture, designs and makes furniture, and teaches others how to do that. And he says he was a trumpet player by training, and he said, "I feel much more like a composer in my work now, because I never composed and I never improvised. I was purely repeating what was in front of me, and now I feel like my voice is present and I'm creating something from nothing." And that's what I'm hearing you saying as well.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I mean, because I know actually another colleague who moved into woodworking from being a professional violinist, and I think his outlook was exactly the same as what you've described.
Yeah, I would love to. We'll have to, after the podcast, get their details. I'd love to hear their story.
I'll see if I can hunt him down for you, yes.
That'd be great. So, Patty, obviously you're learning lots of in the GA boot camp. You learnt lots of new technical skills. What have you learnt about yourself through that process?
Well, I think one thing that I've learned is that I think, first of all, that my background as a musician has helped me with all of this. I think it's maybe more of a general statement rather than one pertaining to me specifically, but I've come away from music with, or I've come through music rather, I haven't come away from it outright. I've come through music with a lot of very tech relevant skills, and things that you kind of take for granted until you go into an environment where they're really prized and treated as, not necessarily rarities, but things that you can't expect everybody to be doing. And I think obviously things like, teamwork, absolutely central to music making, especially if you're an orchestral musician. In an orchestra, if you decide to show off, that's usually when you don't get booked for the next gig. Like, it doesn't matter how well you play. You have to be, indistinguishable from the other 11 cellists around you playing all the same music. If for whatever reason you stick out, then your ego has gotten the better of you, and they will find somebody more suitable for the team. So I think I discovered that, particularly in team projects, that I'd come to the boot camp with kind of a built-in tendency to defer to other people, just as a hangover from that. And that is not necessarily a good thing. It's not a bad thing either, because I make sure everybody gets to have a voice, but I guess I've had to learn to advocate for myself a bit more and to stand up for, my ideas and my concepts and the sort of eventualities I can see a bit further down the line if we pursue this path instead of this one. And that's taken some doing, but I think I also got an amazing amount of support. I think that's another thing that I discovered, was that I took a bit of time to adapt to working in a field where you're dealing with margins of error that are just a little bit more favorable than one wrong note and you're out. In GA, I used to submit homework every evening, plus there'd be a weekend challenge, and then our wonderful, delightful TAs would mark them and give some feedback. And I would also have to just fill out a very, very basic questionnaire, nothing too complex or too time consuming, but just to kind of give marks out of five as to how I responded to the challenges and the nature of the task and so forth. And there'd be a section at the end where I could leave any additional comments. And seriously, like, for the first 5 or 6 weeks, my comment was like, please gut my code and be brutal, just because this is what I was accustomed to. I think I gradually sort of encouraged more and more candor out of them as the weeks progressed. But I can see that they weren't out to tear me down. They were out to just guide me, and I think that's probably a bit healthier. And I think generally in tech, definitely at the level where I currently am, sort of looking for my first job, but there is not an expectation that I need to already know everything going into the job. But there's a willingness to take people on based off of what you believe them to be capable of, and then give them the necessary training and mentorship, and encourage them to keep asking questions, even if they've asked you a million questions already that day. So I think it's given me a lot more confidence, a lot more belief in myself, just because I know that if I hit a brick wall, it's normal, and I don't have to endure it on my own without any external help. I think kind of the final surprise that really has come to me is that there's been a lot of talk sort of throughout the boot camp of imposter syndrome, and that's understandable, because with one or two exceptions, we were all career changers. And there were some people who were changing career from fields that are traditionally regarded as being very close to tech, and other people like me who, despite the parallels between the two fields, were changing from fields that were traditionally regarded as being very distant to tech. But I think the thing that's really surprised me is that the imposter syndrome that I get is far stronger as a cellist than it is as a software developer, because I've only been coding for a matter of months, and why should I be an expert already? And also because nobody's expecting me to be an expert yet. So I might write code that has sort of more errors in it than I would, produce in an audition. But I think within the audition, the one error will make me feel far worse, and there'll be more finality about it. I'll feel like I've let myself down more. And I find that to be a very interesting paradox, and I'm still wrapping my head around it because it's kind of crept up on me.
And I'm hearing also, Patrick, this interesting kind of dynamic coming out in your story about, oh, I'm a beginner at something, and maybe I didn't expect to be a beginner at something as an adult, because I had expected I was going to pursue a life in music. So I've been a highly, highly trained expert at a thing that had no margin for error. And now I'm a beginner at a thing, and I'm actually enjoying getting stuff wrong. Or it's almost that delight in finding the errors and correcting them for yourself or learning. And that, I think it's that it's I what I'm I think what I think is coming out in you is this surprise at the permission that you are allowing yourself to fail.
Yeah, 100%. And I think you raise a very important point about sort of the fact that I'm learning a very complex set of skills, from scratch as an adult. And I think actually when I started my self-study before in the sort of weeks and months before I actually enrolled in the boot camp, I quickly discovered that I was having to learn how to learn. And I was having to sort of structure my day and decide how much time to allocate and sort of how to revise. And obviously, as a musician, the learning is continuous because, we always have new music in front of us. We always have new ensembles in which we're playing, new environments, new acoustics. We have to adapt to all of it somehow. But you're learning from a very high level, and you're sort of learning whatever's above that level or whatever's parallel to that level. You're not learning from the very beginning. Like, nobody's going to book you for a gig and say, okay, by the way, can you figure out how to play the crumb horn in like 3 weeks? It's great to be starting something from scratch and to figure out my strategies for developing optimally. And it's fun to be able to fall on my face and know that it's okay. It's a relief. It's very, very liberating.
I'm wondering if that's because this is where you were when you were 13 and you discovered a thing that you fell in love with and became obsessed with this. Like you said, I'd get up at 5 a.m. and press record on the cassette player to record some cello music. And I wonder if you are having a similar experience now as you had when you first fell in love with the cello.
I think so, yeah. I mean, obviously I'm a bit less beholden to like radio schedules these days. Yeah, I'm finding that I'll be sort of solving some katas on Code Wars and just kind of, flexing some Python muscles or whatnot and just trying to improve my skills. And I'll come up with a solution. I'll submit it, and then I get to see what everybody else came up with. And then I'll just look through the solutions. I'll see something that I can't immediately fathom, but it's incredibly concise, and so I get very curious and I Google it. And then I'll just sort of, end up excitedly ranting to my wife for the next 15 minutes about this amazing Python method I never knew it existed that just does everything. And yeah, it's the same sort of, discovery. Everything is new at the moment, and it just means that I keep finding, awesome things that weren't in my consciousness a year ago, or even more recently than that. And just every day is an adventure.
The delight, the just the joy and the delight that's coming out of you as you're speaking about this discovering this pl and the play is also what I'm hearing you speak about, this beautiful, fertile, messy, incorrect experience of having a go at something as a beginner with that, without the judgment and the expectation of it having to be, you know, correct. It's just, it's so wonderful to see that coming out of you, and that you found a space where the experience that you had early in music of playfulness and immersion and exploration is, you're able to come back to that, and it's going to, you know, it's helping you move into a new career model that's going to support you and your family ongoing and give you choices. I also loved, Patty, you were saying about the comment used about they said the willingness to take people on based on what they think you're capable of, and how that's an understanding that you're a whole person, and the skill is part of what they're hiring for, but it's not the only thing that they're hiring for, because you have to be able to, exactly as you said, get along as part of a team. And that, you know, I wish there was more of that in the kind of way classical music works, that we could hire beyond the skill. Obviously, you said the same thing, you know, you must be able to play, but lots of people can play. So beyond that, yeah, what are the hiring practices and an education model that supports people to understand that they must first and foremost be a whole person?
Yeah, I think that would be a very healthy approach to adopt. I mean, you know, I can't envision yet sort of how the curriculum about it would, you know, be constructed, but you know, we've only just touched upon it now, so I imagine that some ideas might come to me in a couple of hours when I'm pretending to sleep. But yeah, I think being a whole person is very important. I think we, as musicians, we sacrifice a lot of ourselves in order to, I guess, in the pursuit of perfection. I think like we've got the strange paradox as musicians where we know that there's no perfection in music and no perfection in technique, but we must dedicate our lives to getting as close to that as possible. And whilst that is like the ultimate driver of, you know, innovation and refinement in music making, there's a big cost attached in terms of people's well-being.
Were you, so when you were living that freelance, fully freelance lifestyle of teaching and performing, did you feel that you were beholden in a way to being able to be a whole person in all of those places?
I think it became easier when my son was born, just simply because overnight a line kind of drew in the sand for me where certain conditions had to be met in order for me to be willing to leave the house. We wanted to be, you know, parents. We set out to have a kid. I was thrilled when he came along, but I was not prepared for just how central he would be to my life, and just how, especially in the early days, if I went out to do a gig, even if I was playing music that I loved, and even if I was working with people that I loved, all I could think about was getting home. So I think that was a point where I started to say no to a lot of things. And the irony was that was the point where there was one more mouth to feed and more difficulty in my wife and I being both able to work at the same time. But it was a moment where I started to see more value in life than just what the next gig was, or where the next fee was coming from. And it definitely made me look for better opportunities, both in terms of, filthy lucre, but also just personal satisfaction. not to mention proximity. I think my catchment area for gigs has definitely converged on London as my son has gotten older. I think the willingness to drive for 5 hours to play for a couple of hours and then drive back, right, it took quite a beating at that point.
And it's also understanding the reality of the freelance lifestyle is you're not at home during the evening, so and you're often not home on the weekends. So as an infant, you're missing that beautiful bedtime bath time, putting them to bed, and then as they become older and they get to school age and they're at home on the weekends, you're not. And so it's actually there's a choice to be made, and just understanding that those things are in conflict with each other, and so people have to decide for themselves whether that's acceptable or not.
100%. And that's sort of a crossroads that I've come to more recently, because initially when he was really little, if I had sort of shows in town, like it was great because I could spend the entire day with him, and then around the time that he was off to his bath, I could just nip into town, sit in a pit for a couple of hours and then go back home. But obviously he's currently at nursery, he's starting primary school month after next, and I need to build my life around his and not the other way around. That's the reality. And I think especially at this juncture, where in contrast with what I was sort of talking about earlier with instrumental lessons, that the world of tech on the whole is super comfortable with remote working and flexible remote working. That is going to be able to grant me more quality time with my son, and that's worth its weight in gold.
It's just so wonderful to hear that you've come at this sort of transition from a point of, both values that you had, that you knew of yourself, wanting to do something that was beyond yourself and help others in a time of need. And that also fits with the way that your life has changed with starting a family, because it upends everything. And it requires everything. Patrick, just a final question to you. Are you playing? Because it's not that long since you've transitioned. So are you still playing?
I am still playing. I mean, things are sort of starting to trickle back in. I've had some tour dates. I've got a bit of session work coming up. What's handy is that a tech job will be some variation of 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. I mean, I think quite a loose umbrella. There are certainly people who will keep very unusual hours if they find that they're more productive in the evenings or whatnot, but there'll be some variation of that. Performing work is some variation of happening on a Saturday. So I'm quite excited about the idea that I will be able to keep the two running in parallel, but I will be able to decide what I want to say yes to, and not feel like I have to in order to be able to keep a roof over the head. And I think that'll be sort of crucial for sort of, I guess, every gig feeling like it's my last. Like if it's a gig where you've elected to be there and there's no financial obligation attached to it, then you can put 110% of yourself into it. You want to be doing it, and you've said yes to it because there's some quality about it that's just right, and that will make your weekend.
And hasn't that come it comes full circle back to the experience that you're going to have, because you've constructed a professional life the experience that you've now had is not I'm doing the gig because I need the money, but exactly as you said, I'm doing the gig because I'm choosing to, because it's going to bring me joy and connection and meaning. And that's what age 13 Paddy was, just this like wide-eyed, gloriously obsessed, finding the joy in the moment. So you've almost come full circle back to that's going to be the experience that you have with the instrument in your hand now.
Yeah, I think so. I definitely feel sort of reinvigorated by having the opportunity to just see things as, channels for discovery or catharsis or just generally something that will hit my soul properly. And no sort of ulterior motives outside of that. It's nice. It's really nice. And already, like with the performances that I've come back to, like I felt very, very different. And even sort of, if it's been something that's been, maybe comparatively mundane in according to my past self, I air quotes, you can't see him, it's radio. I still feel like I can enjoy it. I can appreciate the music for what it is. I can enjoy the sensation of performing, the sensation of playing, the sensation of listening even. And yeah, I think everything's just a bit greener, and that's really comforting.
Patty, thank you so much. This has been just a wonderful romp through your story, and so just so encouraging to hear the not just the tactical and the practical of how you've gone about this, but actually much deeper about what's the kind of emotional journey and the inner experience that's happened for you. I'll put links to anything we've discussed in the show notes, but we're so grateful for your time, and thank you for sharing with such honesty. I really appreciate it. Thanks, Patty.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for having me. This has been a joy for me as well.
Hey, thanks for listening and for making it all the way to the end. If you've enjoyed this episode, then please help me share these stories by sharing this with others. You can post about it on your socials, on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, or you can leave me a rating and a review about this podcast. To catch all the latest from me, you can follow me on Facebook or Instagram at Notable Values. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next time.